As many of you know, I don't just have the great blessing of being a regular host on Coast to Coast AM every Saturday night and then on Sunday night occasions like this, and then sometimes filling in for George Norrie during the week. But I also host a morning show. And so it is, too, that I do about 15 hours a week, too, that I do volunteer work for the church to which I've been ordained. And then I've, you know, I've got duties as a dad and a husband. So, you know, I've got a lot on my plate. So I am often seemingly in kind of a state somewhere between awake and sleepiness. I am prone to cat napping. I tend to do them when I don't want to, not driving or anything like that. That's never a hazard. But when I'm waiting in a doctor's office for 15 minutes, I've been known to just immediately go to sleep the second I sit down. In between phone calls sometimes, working on Coast to Coast, I can be on hold for 5 minutes and I can fall asleep. So I've been sort of interested in seeing how information is processed during these states of sleeplessness, where somebody will talk to me or I will be doing some work, for example, in a studio, and I'll be actually cutting a promo along with somebody else, and I'll be in a state of semi-consciousness. I'll lean my back up against the wall in a chair, and in a state that I can only describe as almost asleep, I can help edit a promo, and then 5 minutes later kind of snap out of it, go back and listen to the promo, and hear that it's what I remember it, but I know I wasn't totally conscious when I was contributing my portion to it. So I say all of this to you because I'm fascinated by the notion of the cusp between awake and sleep, wakefulness and sleep. This came up in play during the conversations about the end of the TV show Lost. This is not a spoiler, but one of the main characters was mortally wounded. And one argument that was made about the events in Lost is that they were all of that which transpired over the six or so seasons of the show were all things that happened in the character's mind in between when he was enduring his mortal wound and when he actually died, that they were just all sort of a mental construct. That similar to the movie Jacob's Ladder, if you ever saw that, Adrian Lyne movie that I like a lot. So, you know, this idea has been explored before. What is it that we are doing with our brains to resolve the issues that are in our minds? When can we know we're awake? When do we know for sure that when we're asleep? What do we do in these various stages of wakefulness? Which ones are helpful to us? How do we work out problems in our awake world, in our sleeping world? How is the brain programmed like that? Well, I asked for a conversation partner on it, and we found Rick Collingwood, who's coming up next hour on Coast to Coast. He's not only a student of consciousness, but he is a teacher of hypnosis. And we'll talk about that, the various stages of wakefulness and how our consciousness and our behavior can be changed. And for that matter, when one is in a post-hypnotic suggestive state, is one awake or is one asleep? We'll explore that coming up next hour and what it means to all of us to understand that better coming up on Coast to Coast. One person who knew he was awake for sure, Martin Richard, a former F-15 fighter pilot who was called into action on 9/11. His story is told in a new business book, but we won't be talking about it from a business standpoint. He writes about how he learned leadership through something like the 9/11 scramble that he went through. But I'm more interested in some of the details of what he experienced and what the other pilots experienced being scrambled on that day and others when it comes to our national security. And he's agreed to talk about that coming up next on Coast to Coast for Memorial Day weekend. This is Ian Punnett. Well, this is going to be a very interesting hour, and I'm grateful to have our guest here who's had some fairly unique experiences. One, I think that a pretty select number of people in America can say that they have. They were scrambled on 9/11 in an F-15 fighter that was preparing to do battle in the air with somebody. They didn't know exactly what. Martin Richard is the man that was not just scrambled that day, but has written the book called Scrambled, in which he talks about the events on 9/11 from a business standpoint as well, learning different aspects of high-pressure leadership. Thank you so much, Martin. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Well, Ian, I want to tell you what an honor it is to be on your show. I'm a big fan of Coast to Coast, and I especially appreciate the work you do. I'm really excited to be on the show.
Good. Well, and so it is that let's explain a little bit about your background, that you were a you are not just a fighter pilot for the National Guard, but you were also a pilot that was working for United Airlines at the time of 9/11. Is that right?
That is correct. Yes.
And so you were stationed in Boston. Was that your usual place that you flew out of for United?
I was actually based out of Chicago with United okay. Airlines.
How was it that you should be scrambled out of Boston on the day of the events?
At our base down on Cape Cod at Otis, we for 35 years had two aircraft fully loaded on sitting alert and ready to go at a moment's notice. And I actually wasn't on alert that day. It was a duty that we rotated throughout our squadron that every pilot in the squadron was qualified to do, had to be qualified to do. And that day I was scheduled for just a normal training mission on a beautiful fall day.
Okay, so ordinarily, and this is helpful for me, that as a National Guard pilot, you could be anywhere. And that would be the day that they might say, you got to do training while you're here. Or was it was always scheduled that you did it out of Cape Cod?
It was scheduled always out of Cape Cod.
Okay.
And, right.
All right. So, and that's why I got the impression that you were living in that area. So you're living in Chicago, but you know you always have this duty that you'll do out of Cape Cod.
Correct. And actually, in my case, I was actually living on Cape Cod, and then commuting out to Chicago for my airline job.
I understand better now. Thank you. All right. So, as a pilot, though, for United, I mean, it's not that you were scheduled that day to fly, but you could have been. For all you know, I mean, for all the randomness of some of the events of 9/11, that could have been you in one of those big, you know, airline passenger jets. That could have been you piloting that.
Could have been, or you know, we had many pilots in my squadron that worked with United and American Airlines at the time.
Could have been either you or any of your buddies, but as it just so happened, you were not flying, but you were scheduled to fly for United the next day on 9/12. You already had your flight assignment.
Correct.
Yeah. All right. So, where were you when you get the call that says you've been scrambled? What happened? What was happening that day?
As I mentioned, I was ready to just go out and do some training south of Cape Cod in our normal training area, and so we had briefed up our mission. We were looking forward to it. I certainly was. It was a chance to take a sports car out for a ride before I went to the real job there, and then the next day, and then so we were actually out doing our pre-flight checks of our aircraft systems, safety checks and systems checks, when I looked over to the left, which is the way our ramp is situated, is where we had our alert jets waiting, and I noticed some rather large F-1 350 trucks coming out of the woodwork, as it were, with their lights blazing, and And what we all recognized was that this was an indication that, you know, there was something going on with the alert jets. And what it was our security forces taking their positions on the airfield.
To protect the jets until they take off.
Correct. And it
okay.
was a standard operating procedure.
How often does that happen?
You know, prior to 9/11, it was probably once every other week at most.
That they would have you get up in one of those jets and they would bring out the black F-150s full of security guys?
Yeah, so we sat, you know, alert, and we were scrambled on anything that was entering our, you know, air defense area of responsibility that had not been properly identified. It could be an aircraft that wasn't squawking the proper code or one that wasn't in the proper radio contact. And so part of the mission was to go out and identify visually these, you know, aircraft. We weren't exactly sure what they were doing.
And how often does it turn out to be drug runners?
I would say that, you know, in my experience doing that mission, anecdotally, I knew about guys who had been scrambled on drug runners. I had never had to do that. So I would say that was fairly rare.
And most of the time, it's people who are making innocent, here, you know me, I'm an idiot on this, so I'll just say it like this, innocent transponder errors or something. They've got the wrong... They're sending the wrong code, or they're not receiving the right transmission.
Correct. Or they're flying where they shouldn't be, you know, prior to 9/11, or, you know, even lost or aircraft in distress. Sometimes we would be scrambled to help those as well.
As a fighter pilot for the National Guard, scrambled at times like that, which was not, you know, this was not something that was foreign to you at all. This is something that happens from time to time. Are you always prepared to shoot somebody down if you need to?
It's an interesting point you bring up, and I would say no. I mean, we're prepared, but the mindset, certainly before 9/11, was that we were going to, you know, clear up some sort of miscommunication or help an aircraft in distress.
So usually you're just eyeballing something up close that they can't see from a in a radar booth or a tower somewhere.
Correct.
Okay. So you're going up to look at it, and then ordinarily you'd be able to call back in and say, or you'd be able to maybe even visually signal the pilot, like, hello, right? I mean, exactly. You would make contact with the pilot in some way to be able to explain that they're doing something wrong and they'd better fix it.
Right. And there's, you know, there's universal procedures that we use in order to do that all pilots know about. So it's a, you know, it's a form of communication, usually nonverbal, but it would get the point across.
We're talking with Martin Richard, who's a former F-15 fighter pilot who was also flying for United. He had both assignments right around 9/11. Just happened that day with his National Guard duties. He was about to take sort of a routine training mission up when 9/11 happened. So but back to the question about shooting down a plane. If it were, say, and this, where I know I'm calling upon the experience of, say, your buddies as opposed to you, but if it were a drug plane, if it were a plane that you might have suspected, you know, somebody was meaning to do harm, were you prepared to shoot down something like that? Are you trained to do it? Do they give you sort of a permission to make that judgment on a plane that looks like it's going to either do somebody harm or is up to no good?
I would say that, you know, we train every day. Obviously, the mission of the F-15 in a broader sense is air superiority. And so we would train every day in regards to weapons employment and tactics and things like that. But, you know, as I mentioned before, especially pre 9/11, the mindset was not that, you know, if you're scrambled, you're arming up and you're getting ready to employ weapons. It really wasn't that kind of a mindset. Now, ultimately, I suppose, but that judgment or that decision was not made in the cockpit. It was executed in the cockpit, but not made in the cockpit. And there were clear and defined procedures and levels of leadership that had to decide that that was the correct course of action to make.
It's somewhere in the playbook, but it's not what you guys usually take with you out on the field.
Correct. And I mean, it's a simple, I mean, it makes sense because, you know, we don't always have the luxury of having all the information that we would like to have, you know, going real fast and real close to the ground. We're hoping that our leadership has the bigger picture. It's just a standard kind of tenet of any high stress situation that, you know, you have to be ready to execute the orders, but you know, you may not be in a position to necessarily have the all the information to make that decision.
So as you say, you're ready that morning of 9/11 to go take your sports car, as you describe it, out for, you know, like a little drive around Cape Cod, out around the ocean, do the training stuff that you're going to do, and then bring it back. But something happens. Obviously, something has happened where the security personnel are coming out and they're securing the area around the jets that are to be scrambled. Who gives you the order that says you're getting in one of those jets, you got to go now?
It's a standard feed through NORAD and our divisional air defense people.
What does it mean to be getting a call through NORAD? What do you know by the call coming through NORAD?
Our what they will do is notify the authorities on the base, and then we will, you know, the alert pilots will, you know, their job at that point is to get out to the jets and make sure they're ready to go. It's just, you know, being proactive, and then they'll await their words, as we call them. So they await whatever information NORAD may have, and sometimes that's a lot of information, and sometimes that's just a little bit of information.
But if NORAD is involved, what does it mean to you as a pilot? It means this is like, you know, this is really happening. This is a big one. This is a real one. I mean, does it mean anything different if it comes down from NORAD?
Well, that's the only place it would come from. So it's, we're used to that, or we would be used to that. We would expect that that's the way the information would flow.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you jump in right away then. You get your orders, you're in, and who else was in that day? Who else was getting scrambled with you?
Well, so I was getting ready for my training mission with seven other guys, and we were basically, when we saw the commotion on the alert side of the ramp, we just got out of their way. And so the two alert pilots were scrambled out, and they took off as quickly as they could once they received the words to take off. And then we followed them out basically with the mindset, again, of going out to accomplish the training objectives we had set for that day.
Okay, so the other jets, the alert jets with the alert pilots, they go. And then you think, wow, I'm just going to go and follow through on my original mission. You're thinking maybe at that point that these other jets are going out to determine, kind of much more in a routine sort of way, somebody that's in airspace that shouldn't be in the airspace, something that's happening that can't be confirmed by the tower or by radar or something, right? I mean, you're still, at this point, you're not thinking the worst.
Well, I'll be honest with you. We weren't even thinking, wow. We were focused on our training mission. We had no idea what was going on and what they were going to be scrambled on. We didn't know any of that information.
When does that change?
We were just entering our training area, and it's a sanitized area. We do a lot of dynamic maneuvering and need a lot of airspace. And one of the air center controllers said, hey, there's something going on in New York City. We think you guys should go back to the base, which was out of the ordinary. So I got on the radio with our squadron ops, and sure enough, they said, okay, well, let's turn everybody around and come on back to base. And that's all we knew at the time was we were told to come on back.
And so you're heading back to your base in Cape Cod?
Correct.
Okay. Well, that's where we'll hang it up for the moment, and we'll come back with Martin Richard back on the day in which he got scrambled. That's the name of the book, in which he talks about the events of 9/11 from the standpoint of what one can learn from leadership, both in life and in combat. It's very well written, very interesting. You can link up to Martin Richard through our webpage at coasttocoastam.com and pick up a copy of the book Scrambled. But there's more of his testimony I want to get to from that day, and in particular about both what he experienced and then what pilots in general experienced. And we'll throw open the phone lines, too, for your questions coming up next. And then next hour, Rick Collingwood, how can you tell when you're awake and when you're asleep? What is the nature of consciousness? We'll get to that next hour on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. As a quick reminder toward next hour, when we'll be talking with Rick Collingwood on the nature of consciousness. How can we tell when we're awake? How can we tell when we're in a dream state? What does hypnosis teach us about that nexus next hour on Coast to Coast? This hour, already the phones are filling up for Martin Richard, who is one of the fighter pilots scrambled on the day of 9/11. He tells the story in his book, Scrambled. You can link up to him at coasttocoastam.com. And he's going to tell you the rest of the story of what he went through that day. And we'll get some of your questions and comments coming up for him, too. Next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. Martin Richard's book, Scrambled, is kind of a business book, but he tells the story of what he went through on 9/11 as sort of a door into a conversation about leadership. We'll take your questions and comments coming up in just a second. But first, I want Martin to tell a little bit more of that story. So here it is, 9/11. He's with other guys. They've gone on a routine training mission, although two other jets that they know of had already been scrambled to participate in some sort of response to 9/11, but details are scant when they're told they better go back to the base. So you're heading back to the National Guard base in Cape Cod, and what's your first thought when you get that indication that something is going on?
It's it's eerily consistent in any high pressure situation that the first casualty is communication. So we're just wondering what is going on and trying to get back to the base safely, but as quickly as we can.
And at some point, then they tell you what? That you need to keep flying, you need to land. What do you have to do next?
Nope, we needed to land and stay by the jets. Of course, we didn't do that. We ran inside to see what was going on and to get a briefing on what exactly was transpiring. And, of course, you know, that's when everything became, I won't say clear, but at least we had an idea of what was going on.
And that were you aware then that it was United Airlines jets that were, that had been hijacked?
You know, we were getting a lot of data, but no information. Another typical situation in a high pressure kind of atmosphere. So no, we did not know. We knew, you know, they were just saying all kinds of things that really weren't indicators to what was going on. Among those things were, you know, hey, several airlines involved, things like that.
But as a United Airlines pilot in your professional life, you didn't know yet that these were colleagues of yours that were in harm's way.
No.
Okay. Now, at this point, they have these, the jets have already flown into the world, have one of them already flown into the World Trade Center by the time you get down, land, and are around a television?
Both of them had.
So what does that mean for you all then? As you know, on this, here you are on this, you know, National Guard base in Cape Cod, then what?
You know, it's really the biggest lesson I learned that day is that you don't always get to choose when you're going to have to lead. And so, you know, we looked around, we tried to get information, none was there. We waited for the jets to be readied for a sortie, but We didn't even know if we were going to be flying again or what was going to happen.
But you didn't know what was being expected of you either. You didn't know what whether you were at this point. Were you thinking at all, uh-oh, we may have to go up and are now, is this the point where you think I might have to shoot somebody down or we have to protect our country in a way that's different than just eyeballing some, you know, drug plane coming into your territory?
Not at that point. We really were searching around for what our mission would be. You know, we're a fairly focused culture, and it's one thing we bring to the discussion when we talk about high-pressure situations is that, you know, you have to have an objective, and we weren't exactly sure what our objective was. So that's where we stood. Even as we lifted off again on the second mission of the day, we weren't exactly sure where we were even going.
And at this point, you have been on the second mission. You are officially scrambled as a jet, so to speak.
Correct. Yes.
Okay. So where do they tell you to go? I mean, you're up. Then what?
The first aircraft that, well, the first thing we did was we were vectored onto, you know, an aircraft that was approaching Boston, but there were four of us, and our sort of limiting factor is the amount of fuel we can carry. So another corollary mission that we had was to track down if any air refueling jets were in the air, which there were, and so that bought us time. So basically, we were chasing around aircraft and making sure that they were going where they needed to go. But no clear mission. No clear
right.
mission at this point.
Is this surprising to you when you look back on the day of 9/11 that nobody knew exactly what to tell you to do? They just were telling you go up and do something.
Well, I don't want to say that nobody knew what to do. I would say that we definitely, I was not receiving that information in my cockpit. And so just like I said, when you look at it from a leadership perspective in a high-pressure situation, really the tide turned when our primary flight lead that day, who was the first man scrambled, really took control of the situation in our area, because other things were going on in other areas. And, you know, he said, hey, this is what we're going to do. This is our mission. How does that sound to you guys? And they said, that's exactly what we want you to do.
And what was the mission decision?
The mission was to set up a combat air patrol right over Ground Zero. And the reason was because, you know, we hadn't focused on a mission like we were encountering on 9/11, but we did have a lot of training on things that looked similar. So what the flight lead did was he said, well, you know, we don't have all the information we need, so we're going to make it look like something we've trained for. If we don't know where they're coming from or how many there are, and if our mission is to protect New York City, then we'll let them come to us.
How many fighter pilots around the country do you think were in the place where you were scrambled on 9/11?
Boy, I'm not even sure. I wouldn't have any way to know that, I don't think.
How many on the East Coast do you think are in the scrambled on 9/11 club?
I don't know specific numbers. I would, you know, I do know that there were guys flying over Washington, D.C.
So maybe 10?
I'm not sure. I just know that, you know, we were so focused on what we were doing that, you know, when I finally flew down to New York City, I had completely forgotten that those guys had been scrambled. It was just, you know, again, another indicator of being under pressure that you sort of lose the big picture. What we say is looking through a soda straw, just focused
sure.
on what you're trying to do.
I'm going to ask one more question. I'll leave the rest up to the questions and comments on the phones for Coast to Coast, and then also refer people to the book Scrambled, which is a business book. But tells the story of what Martin Richard went through that day and helps to explain exactly how you might learn from that experience, both in combat and in life. But this would be my question. If you had been called to fly over western Pennsylvania and shoot down the jet, that the remaining jet that was being held captive by the hijackers, would you have been able to shoot down the passenger jet if you had gotten permission, if you'd been given, sorry, even an order that said, no, you must take it down? Would you have been able to hit that button?
Well, we would have had to. That would have been our order. What I can tell you is that, I don't think, and, you know, history proves that we would have ever had enough information for our leaders to make that call. And so on that day, our focus was to get everything flying in the air down onto the concrete safely. And so we spent hours intercepting airliners and making sure that they were complying with the controller's instructions to land at the nearest piece of concrete.
I understand that. The question, I guess, that I'm really pointing at here is the number of people who say that that particular jet was shot down over western Pennsylvania. It was shot down by our own forces, and we just won't admit it. And I don't, I just happen to be of the mind that that if we did shoot it down ourselves, if it wasn't brought down, and I think it was brought down heroically by the passengers on that jet, that if somebody like yourself had to shoot it down, there wouldn't have been any pushback on it. There wouldn't have been, I can't believe they did that. I think everybody would have understood that this was your order and that there was a greater good, that these people were turning the jet around to take it back to Washington and to find another target.
And, you know, with, you know, it's something, you know, we think about often. I thank God every day we didn't have to make that decision. And, you know, like you said, I'll leave it in the hands of the heroes that took United 93 into their own hands.
Did you know the pilot?
I didn't know the pilot, nope.
Did you know any of the pilots for United that day?
Personally, I did not. I knew I had flown with a couple of the flight attendants on board one of the aircraft.
I'm sorry for your loss, too. And thank you so much for your questions and for your service and for... I think on this Memorial Day, it's only appropriate to think not just about the servicemen and women who have lost their lives to this country, but also on 9/11 to the first responders who were just as much on the front line of that terrorist attack as anybody else. Let's get to Rick in Los Angeles on Coast to Coast. Hey, Rick.
Yes. Hi, gentlemen. You know, 93, I think, is the one that landed, crashed in Pittsburgh, right?
Just outside of Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Well, you know, I read, and I think this is very reliable, the transportation safety, some of the officials that arrived, they couldn't find any plane parts there. They were not able to find anything substantial. But the point I wanted to make is there are two things I wanted to mention that I think are just a very small part of an overwhelming body of evidence that really points to an inside job on this thing. There were, NORAD had training exercises going on. They were in another part of the country. The same thing happened with the London bombing. Both of them were doing simulated exercises for an attack, the same type of attack, Twin Towers. The other one was London bombings, the subway. And they were doing it on the same day in other locations. Now, I think the coincidence...
Okay, well, let's get our guest a chance to respond to that. So Rick says it's an inside job. Where are you with that, Martin?
Well, all I can say is that, you know, I wrote a business book about and drawing on my experiences. It's certainly not a research book. And, you know, the fact that I was scrambled on 9/11 is a matter of fact, not conjecture. I used anecdotes to illustrate specific leadership principles, and that's about all I can say about that.
Well, he makes the point to say that although I think there are actually parts that they find and everything, I think this notion that they didn't find anything in western Pennsylvania is not true. But right there, there's a claim somehow that something didn't happen that we thought happened. And as a United Airlines pilot, as well as a National Guard pilot, what do you think of that likelihood? That something was either blown up, the plane was blown up, as in part of an inside job. No thoughts?
I don't even want to talk about that. I don't think anything of it, to be honest with you.
Tom is in Knoxville on Coast to Coast for Martin Richard, author of the book Scrambled. You can link up to it on our webpage. Tom?
Hi, how you doing, guys?
Great, Tom.
Hi, Martin. I'm sorry you have to listen to all this conspiracy stuff tonight. My question is, your book's based on leadership, and you take yourself out of the cockpit. You were at the National Military Command Authority. You were advising. What changes or what kind of policies would you suggest to keep something like this from happening again?
That's an excellent question. That's a really good question.
Thanks, Tom. Yeah. I think we did some really good work after 9/11. It's out there, not only with just how we did business after 9/11, but also how we integrated or didn't integrate with the airlines as a whole. So I think some great progress was made.
What would you do different? You wouldn't do anything different?
I don't know that I wouldn't do anything differently. I don't know that I can comment on specific things I would do differently. I would just say that the level of understanding between what we do and what the airlines do is like night and day.
Would there need to be more coordination then?
Well, those are the things that we looked at after 9/11, and I say we with, we and the broadest sense of the terms. It involved the airline unions, it involved airline pilots, it involved aircraft systems on our jets. Were they compatible? Were they not? How can we make communication better? Like I mentioned before, in every high stress situation I've been in, communication is always the first casualty. We get a lot of data, but we don't get a lot of information. And so, what can we bring technology-wise and just, human performance-wise to the game to make sure that we're all on the same sheet of music.
Ernest has got a question. He's in Houston on Coast to Coast for Martin Richard, one of the handful of pilots scrambled on 9/11. Ernest?
Richard, what would speech be to the other pilot? Would it be, you're off course? Can you recorrect your course? If you don't, we'll have to shoot you down. Would it be that speech or?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. What would you say to get them to correct their course?
There are standard signals that are standard operating procedures where we would rock our wings to say, hey, you've been intercepted, and then get them pointed in the right direction. If we could establish radio contact, we certainly would rather do that. Sometimes that's you're able to do that, and sometimes you're not. And it's just like, in any kind of life situation, sometimes you have all the tools of communication you need, and sometimes you don't. So you have to overcome that barrier. But it's, it's certainly not a one-and-done kind of a thing. You know what I mean?
Sounds like, in a way, like you're still learning, like we are all still learning from what happened on 9/11. Thank you so much for your time, and good luck with this book. And again, you can link up to the book Scrambled at coasttocoastam.com, and you can read more about what happened with Martin Richard and the other pilots that day that were scrambled over New York City and sort of ad-libbed, I guess, in a way, a response to Ground Zero. And I'll just leave the rest up for you all to fill in those blanks later on. Thank you so much for your time. And should something like this come up again, do you mind if we give you a buzz back?
Anytime. You're the best, Ian.
Well, you're very nice to say that. Thanks. Glad to have you on there, and good luck with Scrambled. What about your consciousness? Is that a little scrambled these days? Are you breaking back and forth between a dream state and being awake? We'll talk about that next on Coast to Coast.